Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the December 13th, 2024 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week, we have an open doorway where the door has been kicked in, and standing in it is Kash Patel, someone I'm not familiar with, but he is the Donald Trump's nominee to lead the FBI. He's wearing kind of an old school detective outfit with a trench coat and a hat. In his left hand, he's holding out a badge that says Trump Bureau of Investigation, and in his right hand he's got a pair of handcuffs, got a real stern look on his face. The headline is Rough Justice, Patel's Threat to Weaponize the FBI Against Trump's Enemies. That is our first main story. Trump taps deep state critic Patel to lead FBI. What happened? As a string of scandals threatened to sink Donald Trump's nominee for defense secretary, the president-elect pushed ahead this week with his plans to get another MAGA firebrand, Kash Patel, confirmed as the next director of the FBI. A former federal prosecutor and congressional aide, Patel has little of the law enforcement and management experience typical of FBI directors. But he shares Trump's disdain for the agency, saying it's riddled with filth and corruption, and that its D.C. headquarters should be shuttered and reopened as a museum of the deep state. Patel also has called for prosecuting journalists who lied about President Biden's effort to rig presidential elections. Former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton compared Patel to Joseph Stalin's secret police boss, and said the Senate should reject this nomination unanimously. Charles Kupperman, Trump's former deputy national security advisor, called Patel untrustworthy and a sycophant, and said his nomination is a gross insult to citizens. But numerous GOP senators offered support. Senator Bill Hagerty, the Republican from Tennessee, said the FBI needs sweeping change, and Kash Patel is just the type of person to do it. Defense Secretary nominee Pete Hegseth's path to confirmation looked increasingly fraught, with a growing number of GOP senators troubled by allegations about the Fox News host's drinking and treatment of women. The New Yorker reported that Hegseth, already facing scrutiny for a 2017 sexual assault allegation, was forced to step down from two veterans organizations after allegations of drunkenness, financial mismanagement, and sexual misconduct. The New York Times published an email in which Hegseth's mother called him a serial abuser of women. And NBC News reported that Hegseth's drinking alarmed Fox colleagues. Senator Lindsey Graham called the reports very disturbing. Hegseth said the allegations were BS and that Trump had told him, "I got your back." Numerous outlets reported that Trump is now considering Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for his defense secretary pick. Trump named real estate developer Charles Kushner, father-in-law to his daughter Ivanka, ambassador to France. Trump pardoned Kushner in 2020 after a 2005 federal conviction on tax evasion, witness tampering, and perjury. His daughter Tiffany's father-in-law, Massad Boulous, a Lebanese-American businessman, was named Senior Middle East Advisor. What the editorial said. Patel is not just unfit to run the FBI, said the New York Daily News. He's unsuited for any job in government. He's a woefully unqualified zealot who, in a recent book, compiled a literal list of 60 enemies of MAGA. Former Trump Attorney General Bill Barr is on there, as is former CIA Director Gina Haspel and current FBI Director Christopher Wray. The last, whom Trump appointed, is 7 years into a 10-year term and has done nothing to warrant his removal for cause, which should be the only way for a president to depose an FBI chief. The next defense secretary faces formidable challenges, said Bloomberg. Head-spinning technological changes are revolutionizing combat, including the attack drones that have reshaped wars in Ukraine and the Middle East. Artificial intelligence is about to transform everything from logistics to targeting. China is expanding its nuclear forces and space capabilities. Culture warrior Hegseth, who has no experience of high command or any background in defense strategy, isn't remotely qualified to manage all this. And Republican senators must insist Trump supply a nominee who is. What the columnist said, Hegseth is a loose cannon who seems virtually guaranteed to dangerously mismanage any organization he leads, said Jill Filipovich in the Daily Beast, especially a department with an $850 billion budget and nearly 3 million troops and civilian workers. The New Yorker expose detailed accusations that Hegseth had to be carried from work events after drinking to excess, pursued female staffers for sex, allegedly led a chant of "kill all Muslims" in an Ohio bar, and in one case had to be physically restrained from jumping on stage at a Louisiana strip club where he'd brought his work team. It looks like Hegseth's bags are packed, said William Crystal in the Bulwark. Just as with Matt Gaetz, Trump's short-lived pick for attorney general, he will have been brought down mainly by his atrocious personal behavior. But we can't overlook the damage these nominees would inflict on America. That's particularly the case with Patel, a morally stunted enforcer who'd used the FBI to carry out Trump's professed agenda of political retribution. His nomination is a hair-on-fire moment, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Patel poses a double threat as a Trump crony. One so loyal, he wrote a trilogy of children's books casting Trump as King Donald and a rabid critic of the very institution he's being asked to lead. Our security agencies are in desperate need of reform, said Eli Lake in the Free Press. After their repeated efforts to undermine Trump during his first term, from the endless leaks to the FBI's prolonged investigation of the Trump campaign's alleged collusion with Russia, one could see why he's on the warpath. But Patel is the wrong guy. Trump needs a true reformer with inside allies, not a bomb thrower who will only damage the agencies further. Even if Patel doesn't reach the goal line, said David Frum in The Atlantic, the damage is done. For decades, FBI directors have been above politics, appointed to 10-year terms that bridge administrations. In scheming to depose Wray, Trump is declaring his intention to reinvent the FBI as an instrument of personal presidential power. Now comes the great test. Will he prevail? If so, the seizure of power he unsuccessfully attempted in 2021 could be underway in 2025. And our second main column, main story. Islamist rebel attack reignites Syrian civil war. What happened? Syrian President Bashar al-Assad suffered a major defeat this week after a rebel coalition took the commercial capital of Aleppo in a lightning advance, rekindling the largely frozen 13-year civil war. Within days of launching an attack from their northwestern stronghold of Idlib, Islamist insurgents had seized most of the city, tearing down posters of Assad as regime forces dropped their weapons and fled. The rebel coalition, led by the former al-Qaeda affiliate Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and including a Turkish-backed militia, also took dozens of other towns and villages. In Aleppo, some locals rushed out to hug the rebels. "They are better than the government," one resident told the BBC, "although there is a lot of fear." Caught off guard, Assad ordered an immediate pay raise for his conscript army and turned to his traditional allies, Russia and Iran, for help. At least 300 Iran-backed fighters entered from Iraq, while Russian jets bombed Idlib and Aleppo, hitting schools and hospitals. But the foreign assistance was less forceful than in previous years, and the Iran-backed Lebanese militia, Hezbollah, didn't participate at all. The war had been at a standstill, with Assad controlling some 70% of Syria, while U.S.-backed Kurdish militants held the northeast and factions aligned with Turkey the northwest. Now, those Turkish-backed groups have shattered the status quo. The rebels have also captured Tel Rifat, the last Kurdish stronghold in the northwest. While some 900 U.S. Special Forces are currently in Syria to assist the Kurds in countering ISIS, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said they are not at proximate risk. "The U.S. has real concerns about the rebels," Sullivan said, "but we don't cry over the fact that the Assad government, backed by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, is facing certain kinds of pressures." What the columnist said. "What an embarrassing rout for Assad," said The Economist. "It took him 4 years to wrest back Aleppo in 2016, the last time insurgents overran the city, but just 4 days this week to lose it. That's partly because his allies are now weaker. In 2016, he had lots of help from Russia air power and from Hezbollah and other Iranian proxies. But now Russia is bogged down in Ukraine, and thanks to Israeli strikes over the past year, Iran has lost many of its top commanders in Syria, and Hezbollah is greatly diminished." Small wonder, then, that Syria's patron Iran would blame the rebel blitz on Israel, said Jamie Detmer in Politico. In fact, the real eminence grise behind it looks to be Turkey. Why? Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants to curtail any real or imagined threats from the Kurds. He also seeks to pressure Assad into reaching a peace deal that could allow the 4.7 million Syrian refugees sheltering in Turkey to go back home. Yet the rebel coalition is shaky, and things could spin out of control in ways Erdogan hasn't anticipated. Russia, which has major military bases in Syria, will stick by Assad, said Nicole Grajewski in The Atlantic. Coming to Syria's rescue in the mid-2010s allowed President Vladimir Putin to reverse the narrative of Russian decline by positioning it as a major power player in the Middle East. The gaps in Moscow's strategy are now apparent, with the collapse of Aleppo's defenses proving that Russia failed to professionalize the Syrian army. But the Kremlin has too much at stake to abandon its ally. With so many states meddling in Syria, the incoming Trump administration will need a national security team that understands the region, said Noah Rothman in National Review. That doesn't include Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's pick for Director of National Intelligence. She has defended Assad, a leader who crushed pro-democracy protests and repeatedly gassed and starved his own people, claiming he was not the enemy of the United States and dismissing evidence of his war crimes as staged. We can hope her views have somehow undergone a wholesale metamorphosis, but they probably haven't. Will Assad survive into the next administration? Asked Daniel DePetris in the Chicago Tribune. Don't count him out. He has defied expectations time and time again, outlasting two, soon to be three, U.S. presidents through a combination of stubbornness and inhumanity. For now, there isn't much the U.S. can do other than monitor how it all plays out. We'll be right back. controversy of the week. Biden, why he broke his promise not to pardon Hunter. With a stroke of his pen, President Biden made a mockery of our justice system and soundly sullied his political legacy, said Rex Hupke in USA Today. After repeatedly and emphatically pledging that he would not pardon his son Hunter, Biden did exactly that this week. The scope of the pardon he signed is breathtaking. It covers not only the gun and tax fraud charges for which Hunter, 54, had already been convicted, but also any other crimes he may have committed since January 1, 2014. In a lengthy statement, Biden explained that while he wrestled with the decision, he believes Hunter was selectively and unfairly prosecuted, an argument that might be more persuasive if Hunter himself hadn't already admitted guilt. Beyond the hypocrisy, Biden has committed a tremendous strategic blunder, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. President-elect Donald Trump is going to start issuing deeply controversial pardons the minute he gets into office next month, likely including a mass pardon of the January 6th Capitol rioters. Thanks to Biden's attacks on the fairness of his own Justice Department, Trump will have a ready-made heat shield against any criticism. This pardon is a stain on Biden's legacy, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But what father wouldn't save his son if he could? Biden has long watched Hunter struggle with enormous pain, the 1972 car crash that killed his mother and sister, his brother Beau's 2015 death from brain cancer, his addiction to cocaine and alcohol. And while Hunter did plead guilty, his offenses, falsely attesting to not being a drug user on a gun permit form, late payment of taxes, are not the kinds of crimes that usually get prosecuted in the first place. Hunter was facing prison time only because an earlier plea deal fell apart and bloodthirsty Republicans pressured the prosecutor to upgrade the charges. In other words, Hunter received harsh treatment because he is Joe Biden's son. It's hardly surprising that the president would seek to remedy that injustice. As for Biden's supposed lies, said Kim Well in The Bulwark, his promises to not pardon Hunter came before Trump made his extreme cabinet picks. Biden may have realized that without a sweeping pardon, a magnified DOJ could resurrect Trump's baseless allegation that Hunter's work for Ukrainian energy firm Burisma was part of a bribery scheme, or gin up other bogus charges. And let's dispense with the idea that pardoning Hunter gives Trump's cover, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. Trump, in his first term, issued some of the most corrupt pardons the country has ever seen, including one to tax cheat Charles Kushner, his son-in-law's father, whom Trump now wants as ambassador to France. The Trumpian sleaze was always going to resume in January, whatever Biden did or didn't do. These defenses reek of whataboutism, said Josh Barrow in his Substack newsletter. Liberals are understandably frustrated that Trump and Republicans get to abuse their power, while Democrats stay constrained by norms and principles. But if Democrats are going to tell voters to back them because the other side is unethical, then they have to act ethically. Situational ethics are Biden's specialty, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. Whether it was tolerating Hunter's peddling of the family name to nab business deals, or the vanity he showed in running for re-election at age 81, Biden will now go down in history as the president who chose, consistently, to prioritize his own feelings over the defense of his country. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for empathy. After a team of British and German researchers found that supermarket shoppers are 58% more likely to purchase individual loose bananas if they're labeled sad singles. The plight of the single bananas is really relatable, said researcher Lisa Ekman. It was a good week for retro styles after marine biologists reported that orcas in Puget Sound are, once again, wearing dead salmon on their heads. The salmon hat phenomenon was first observed in 1987, and researcher Deborah Giles says that, honestly, We have no idea why this started again. It was a good week for setting the record straight. After Victor Willis, 73, co-writer of the 1978 Village People mega hit YMCA, threatened to sue media outlets that called the song a gay anthem. This false assumption, said Willis, is based on the fact that his writing partner and several members of the Village People were gay, that the YMCA was known as a gay hangout, and that the band's debut LP was totally about gay life. But it was a bad week for refreshment after a Japanese convenience store chain debuted a new thirst quencher, drinkable mayonnaise. A long-awaited new product for mayonnaise lovers, Nomu Mayo apparently offers the richness of and sourness of mayonnaise reproduced in a chilled beverage. It's a bad week for probable cause after New Zealand police seized an envelope full of cash from a motorcycle gang, thinking it was labeled drugs profit. Analysis later revealed that the handwritten label contained an A instead of a U, and police returned the envelope, which held the profits from a drag racing event. Finally, it was a bad week for disorganized crime after the 11th generation Himonya family of the Inagawa Kai, a Japanese Yakuza syndicate, released a statement vowing strict action against the surge of fraud and petty crime in its territory, assuring locals that we are working to create a safe community. And in other news, GOP left with narrow House majority after final race called. A California Democrat flipped a seat to win the last uncalled House race this week, leaving Republicans with the smallest majority in the chamber since the 1930s. Former California state lawmaker Adam Gray defeated incumbent GOP Representative John Duarte by 187 votes to take the Central Valley seat. Republicans will hold 220 House seats to Democrats' 215, a one-seat improvement for Democrats. But for the first few months of the next Congress, Republicans will have only a 217 to 215 majority. That's because GOP Representatives Elise Stefanik of New York and Mike Waltz of Florida are expected to take positions in President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet, while former Florida Representative Matt Gaetz resigned from the chamber last month. Those seats won't be filled until the spring. Republicans now have no room for error, said House Democratic Caucus Chair Pete Aguilar, the Democrat from California. The briefing this week is Joe Rogan's World. The podcaster has become a political force and helped push the manosphere toward Trump. How popular is Rogan? He's the world's biggest podcaster, and it's not even close. The Joe Rogan Experience, recorded two or three times weekly in Rogan's $14 million Austin mansion, is downloaded about 200 million times a month. On Spotify, which since 2020 has paid Rogan an estimated $350 million for rights to the show, Rogan has 14.5 million followers, nearly triple his nearest competitor's numbers. A tattooed, muscular stand-up comic who's worked as a sitcom actor, Ultimate Fighting Championship commentator, and host of the NBC reality show Fear Factor, Rogan has an audience that skews young and, according to one study, is 80% male. Each podcast episode typically features a single guest, whom Rogan genially engages in hours-long free-form conversations, sometimes fueled by whiskey and marijuana. His pre-election three-hour interview with Donald Trump has been viewed more than 52 million times on YouTube. Vice President Kamala Harris chose not to go on the show, citing scheduling conflicts. That sit-down, plus Rogan's last-minute endorsement of the Republican, led UFC president and Trump ally Dana White to publicly thank the mighty and powerful Joe Rogan at Trump's election night victory party. What are Rogan's politics? His show, which launched in 2009, isn't overtly political. His favored topics include comedy, mixed martial arts, alternative medicine, aliens, and psychedelic drugs. Many guests are UFC fighters or fellow comics. He also hosts musicians and actors, Silicon Valley billionaires like Elon Musk, as well as neuroscientists and bioengineers. Until recently, Rogan, 57, called himself a leftist. He endorsed Senator Bernie Sanders in the 2020 Democratic primary and has supported gay marriage, abortion rights, and a universal basic income. "I go left on everything," he said in 2019, "basically except guns." But Rogan, who once called Trump an existential threat to democracy, says he was driven away from the Democratic Party by government COVID restrictions and the censorious progressive left. Both figured into his decision to leave Los Angeles for Austin in 2020. "We'll soon face a society," he said in 2021, "where straight white men are not allowed to talk." Such pronouncements have made Rogan a hero for many disaffected young men and a villain for critics who say he spreads misinformation and pseudoscience. Does he spread misinformation? During the pandemic, Rogan hosted crank scientists such as virologist Dr. Robert Malone, who claimed mass formation psychosis had led people to believe in the efficacy of COVID vaccines, and cardiologist Peter McCullough, who said the pandemic was planned. Rogan treated his own case of COVID with an antiparasitic drug, ivermectin. Studies show it has no effect on the virus, and said healthy young people don't need to get vaccinated. Such comments led 270 doctors and scientists to write an open letter to Spotify in 2022, asking that the company moderate misinformation on its platform. Rogan has also drawn heat for hosting conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and for saying the 1969 moon landing was faked. He's since changed his mind, and that U.S. intelligence agents acted as agent provocateurs during the January 6th Capitol riot. Rogan counters criticism by calling himself a effing moron, whom nobody should consider a respected source of information. But many listeners do consider him just that, and also place trust in the influencers and podcasters who make up the wider manosphere. What is the manosphere? It's a cluster of young male social media stars who share Rogan's irreverence, humor, and massive influence among young men. They include Will Compton and Taylor Lewin of Barstool Sports' Bussin' with the Boys podcast, the Southern California-based prank troupe known as the Nelk Boys, streamer Aiden Ross, comedian and podcaster Theo Vaughn, and Logan Paul, a pro wrestler whose YouTube channels have more than 30 million followers. These influencers crack jokes and banter about sports, fighting, women, pop cultures, and video games, and share Rogan's disdain for a society they see as too woke and feminized. Still, the content they produced for years wasn't overtly political, until the run-up to the November election. What happened then? They embraced Trump, and Trump, in turn, courted bro podcasters to boost his support among young men. He discussed the existence of aliens with Paul. "It's very possible," said Trump. Accepted a Tesla Cybertruck from Ross on the live stream, and queried Vaughn about cocaine. "It will turn you into a damn owl, homie," Vaughn told him. Trump golfed with the Nelk boys and promoted Send the Vote, a $20 million PAC aimed at registering young male voters. While it's hard to draw an exact line between his appearances and his electoral victory, Trump this year won men under 30 by 13 percentage points after losing them by 15 points to Biden in 2020. Some pundits have called this the first podcast election or influencer election and say political campaigns must adapt to this new media environment. Is legacy media still important? TV news continues to draw huge audiences at important national moments, but its ability to shape political discourse is waning as Americans turn to new sources of information. While Trump buddied up to Logan Paul, he turned down the CBS stalwart 60 Minutes, which once had vast influence. Legacy media is dying, said Jess Rauchberg, a communications professor at Seton Hall University. Politicians are now chasing the podcasters and the independent news creators. Trump's success will accelerate that trend, as will Democratic shifts. About 37% of 18 to 29-year-olds say they regularly get their news from social media, according to a Pew Research survey. Charlie Ricker, a 23-year-old from Montana, told the New York Times that he follows politics through the Nelk Boys and other online personalities, kind of like older people do with the news, he said. And a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Sleepwalking into another pandemic. The only thing standing between us and the next global pandemic is luck, said Zeynep Tufekci. The HFN1 bird flu has already mutated across species, from birds to pigs to cows, and is raging among the nation's dairy herds. If this virus swaps segments of its RNA with that of the seasonal flu, an entirely new and deadly virus could acquire the ability to easily spread among humans and trigger another pandemic. The ultra-lethal 1918 Spanish flu, which killed upward of 50 million people, likely started in farm animals. A recent study of 115 farm workers found that 7% had been recently infected with H5N1 and had been going about their lives while harboring the potential seed of a new pandemic. Yet the Biden administration has not responded with any urgency on testing cows or mass-producing bird flu vaccines. Under Donald Trump's administration, expect things to get far worse. His top health pick, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has said he wouldn't prioritize vaccines during a pandemic. As the bird flu quietly spreads among farm animals and humans, we may soon run out of luck. A bird flu pandemic would be among the most foreseeable catastrophes in history. It's not all or nothing on trans rights. Democrats can retreat on trans rights without engaging in complete surrender, said Jonathan Chait. The Trump campaign hammered Democrats for supporting trans women competing in women's sports and state-sponsored trans surgeries for prison inmates. And research shows that the issue did tremendous damage to Kamala Harris in the election. The third most common reason that lay deciders and swing voters opposed Harris was the perception that she was focused on cultural issues like transgender issues rather than helping the middle class. Some activists and progressives insist it would be morally unthinkable to compromise on any element of the trans rights agenda, but it's not all or nothing. Democrats should defend the right of people to change their gender identity and to be protected from discrimination, bullying, and harassment. At the same time, progressives can drop a few highly unpopular positions, such as letting trans women and trans girls play female sports and allowing gender-questioning minors to undergo medical procedures without extensive diagnosis and therapy, and reasonable wait times. Activists decry any moderation as transphobic. But if taking absolutely and highly unpopular trans rights positions keeps costing Democrats elections, it will serve only to put the real transphobes in power and transphobic policies into law. This column comes from Austria. Burying evidence of the Holocaust. Austria's tradition of pretending we had nothing to do with the Holocaust has reached a new low, said Michael Ortner and Matthias Winterer. A real estate company owned by Andreas Raumharter, the mayor of Lobersdorf, has just sold the site of the Mauthausen concentration camp barracks to an entrepreneur who plans to build a business park. Raumharter gets $16 million, and the rest of us get a parking lot instead of a museum, a designer outlet instead of a memorial plaque. The prospect is so horrifying that it sounds like satire, but it shouldn't be surprising. Austria started distancing itself from its Nazi past before World War II was even over. In 1945, while prisoners were still being murdered at Mauthausen, we wrote a founding document declaring that Germany had dragged us into a senseless war of conquest that no Austrians ever wanted. When camp survivors tried to hold their first memorial ceremony in 1946, the government reinterpreted it as a site of the Austrian freedom struggle, laying wreaths not to Jewish Holocaust victims, but to Austrians who resisted the Nazis. Austria covered up its hand in the genocide, and the nation swallowed the lie. This culture of forgetting, created to evade shame, is now helping the unscrupulous make a quick buck. And time for the last word, our in-depth article. The rise of embryo adoption. Snowflake babies created from leftover embryos have helped some Christians make peace with IVF, said Joanna Weiss in Politico. The process could be an option for secular would-be parents, too. Nearly 3 years into her marriage, Emily Burning suspected there was some reason why she wasn't getting pregnant. A few highly unpleasant tests at a fertility clinic gave her the answer. Her fallopian tubes were blocked. It was a cruel irony for a one-time college anti-abortion activist who now runs an anti-abortion charity out of her Florida home. "I really was sad about the idea of not being able to experience pregnancy," she says, "especially since we work with so many pregnant women. I think it's absolutely beautiful." But Burning didn't want a risky surgery to unblock her tubes, and she felt uneasy about in vitro fertilization, or IVF. She firmly believes that life begins at conception, and she didn't feel right about creating embryos that might later be destroyed. One day, her mother-in-law, listening to a Focus on the Family radio show, discovered a path to parenthood that Burning had never imagined. An adoption agency called Nightlight Christian Adoptions had a program called Snowflakes, which specialized in donations of embryos left over from IVF. Burning could take possession of an embryo from another couple's fertility procedure, implant it in her uterus, and give birth to the baby herself. In some circles, these children are known as snowflake babies, a term Nightlight coined in reference to the way IVF embryos are stored. in sub-zero temperatures. They represent a small sliver of the assisted reproduction landscape, their births largely facilitated by faith-based agencies. And for two decades, they've been political symbols used to bolster arguments about the beginning of life. In 2005, then-President George W. Bush invited 21 snowflake babies to the White House to underscore his opposition to stem cell research that destroyed embryos in the process of studying diseases. In 2022, the first ever snowflake baby filed an amicus brief in the Dobbs case that brought about the end of Roe v. Wade, arguing that her existence proves that life starts at fertilization. But now, people on both sides of the abortion wars are embracing embryo donation, not as a weapon, but as a uniting force. The practice has long been embraced by Christian families who might otherwise have qualms about IVF, because it can be seen as a solution to the most troubling part of the process, the disposal of frozen embryos. Lately, though, some advocates have been trying to spread the word about embryo donation beyond the religious communities. Removing the Christian wrapping, these advocates say, would attract non-traditional families, raise hopes for would-be parents, and promote an option that's vastly more affordable than IVF. Most people don't know that embryo donation exists, either as a donor or a recipient. They're just not aware. And most people will say, "I wish I knew about this sooner," says Deb Roberts, a single mother and abortion rights supporter who gave birth to two children from donated embryos and went on to found a non-faith-based embryo donation agency. I spoke this year to Burning, Roberts, and other parents from across the political spectrum who have given or received IVF embryos. Their urgency to promote this practice has grown since the Dobbs decision, which encouraged some anti-abortion activists to set their sights on IVF. Last summer, the Southern Baptist Convention, the nation's second-largest Christian denomination, passed a resolution opposing IVF. Politicians have stepped in, prompting the usual partisan squabbles. In the U.S. Senate, Republicans recently blocked a Democratic bill to protect IVF, calling it a political stunt, while Democrats accused them of putting fertility treatments in jeopardy. But many embryo donation advocates are thinking beyond politics and are focused on the practical. What IVF represents, above all, is a path to parenthood. And in that deeply held bipartisan desire, there's ample room for common ground. "We do believe that these embryos are little lives that are just waiting for a chance to be born," said Beth Button, executive director of Snowflakes. "But quite honestly, this is an option that anyone can consider, regardless of where they believe on the spectrum life begins." The reserve of frozen embryos in the U.S., some estimate there are as many as 1.6 million, is an unintended consequence of IVF, a once revolutionary, now commonplace procedure pioneered in the 1970s. It begins when doctors surgically remove an egg from a fertility patient's body, fertilize it with sperm from in a petri dish, and allow it to divide and grow. After 5 or 6 days, when it has divided into 100 to 200 cells and is technically known as a blastocyst, the embryo is transferred into a uterus, where it may or may not develop into a pregnancy. The process is inexact enough and costly enough that fertility patients regularly create more embryos than they're likely to use, leaving them with extras, sometimes dozens of them, along with a challenging set of options. They can dispose of the embryos, they can donate them to medical research, or they can store them in canisters of liquid nitrogen at minus 321 degrees Fahrenheit for months or years or even decades at a cost of $500 to $1,000 per year. The status of these embryos in cryogenic limbo has vexed some religious conservatives for decades. Louisiana has a law preventing the destruction of embryos, forcing fertility clinics to store their embryos out of state. Within the Catholic Church, which officially forbids IVF, Ethicists have debated whether it's an embryo's best interest to stay frozen forever and question whether destroying an embryo is equivalent to taking an adult life off of life support. Earlier this year, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that they should be considered unborn children, though the state legislature quickly passed a law to protect clinics from liability and largely undo the ruling. But many religious couples have used IVF to build their families. Button notes that despite Rome's edicts, there are plenty of Catholics among the snowflake donors and recipients. Indeed, the concept of embryo adoption began in the 1980s with a deeply religious couple who had gone through unsuccessful fertility treatments. So they approached the director of Nightlight Christian Adoptions, who happened to be a friend. The agency helped create an agreement that would embed a property transfer, because in every state, embryos are technically property, into a process that looked and sounded like adoption. To do that, Snowflake developed a detailed matching process that linked donors and recipients. Families create presentations about themselves. They list their preferences for a matching family's race, religion, and marital status, and cite the level of communication they'd want after a baby is born. Many choose ongoing relationships, sharing photos and videos, and even planning visits. Donors submit blood work and provide a medical history. Recipients submit to a home study. We're vetting families, Button explains, and this is giving peace of mind to the families placing embryos with us. After Sterling and Eileen Osborne, a couple in Connecticut, gave birth to two boys through IVF, they were stunned to learn that they had five extra embryos and a wrenching new set of decisions to make. Destroying the embryos was not an option for us, said Eileen, a former music teacher. To me, it's still potential life, and I would want to give any child a chance to live. Still, it was hard to get their heads around the implications of embryo donation. Could they bring themselves to part with their genetic material? Did they have the moral right to choose who would parent their embryos? What if, later in life, their sons accidentally met their biological siblings? It's an absolute emotional roller coaster, Sterling told me. It's as much of an emotional roller coaster as going through the initial process of IVF. The Osbornes wound up donating their embryos through Snowflakes to a couple in California. Months later, they got a notification that the couple had given birth to twins, a boy and a girl. They're people, Eileen told me, describing how the news hit her. They're into this world now. There are pictures, and this is definitely real. Burning, 29, loved imagining embryos growing into people. She and her husband founded a nonprofit called Let Them Live, which offers pregnant women money for food, rent, and other bills, along with financial counseling, if they'll pledge not to have abortions. Her extended family has experience with traditional adoption. Snowflakes seemed an extension of that idea. It didn't make sense for us to create our own embryos when there are other embryos existing, she says. My husband and I are just huge advocates of life at every stage. When I asked her about the Southern Baptist resolution opposing IVF, Burning told me she thought hard about it and decided that she agrees. The dignity for human beings trumps anyone's desire to have a family, and that includes us, she told me. If there were no embryos to adopt, then that would be that. Last year, Burning acquired a set of 15 embryos and prepared for the implantation process. The embryos had been frozen in 1995, which meant they were technically as old as she was. 13 stopped growing as soon as they were thawed. The remaining two were implanted. Burning sent me a picture of herself, beaming as she holds up a picture of the embryos. But when she took a pregnancy test 2 weeks later, she learned the embryos hadn't successfully implanted. She posted a video of herself on TikTok, sobbing when she got the news. They were going to have to try again. It took Roberts multiple tries, too, before she was able to get pregnant via donated embryo. a Colorado marketing executive who is single and Jewish. Roberts had gone through many unsuccessful IVF attempts by the time she was in her 40s. Calculating her age and the cost of the procedures, she realized that embryo donation might be her last best chance at motherhood. But she found that fertility clinics lacked the time or expertise to match families, vet the embryos, or manage the transfer process. She tried some faith-based embryo donation agencies. One turned her away because she wasn't married, and one told her she'd face a 3-year wait. Button says Snowflakes warns single parents and LGBTQ plus couples that they might have to wait to find a willing donor. So Roberts reached out to friends and acquaintances, posted a call for embryos on Facebook, and got multiple offers of embryos to spare. She found lawyers to help navigate a combination of property law, accounting for the fact that human tissue can't legally be bought or sold, and family law that would give her full custody of any children who resulted. She handled the logistics, at one point carting a canister of frozen embryos from one clinic to another in the front seat of her car, strapped into the seatbelt. She wound up giving birth to a son, and 2 years later a daughter, from the same batch of embryos. Full bio-siblings, she calls them. Then she started her own agency, Embryo Connections, and set up a process that's in many ways similar to Snowflakes. Questionnaires for placing families and intended parents, medical tests to track donors' genetic history, evaluations to make sure only the most viable embryos are donated. One difference is that Roberts doesn't use the term adoption. Still, she applied for a grant from a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services program called Embryo Adoption Awareness and Services, created by Congress in 2002, amid debates over stem cell research. The $1 million annual appropriation has traditionally gone to faith-based groups, but this year, Roberts' agency is one of 3 secular recipients. Roberts is surprised that amid the hand-wringing over IVF, more people aren't talking about embryo donation. I've been shocked at all the news coverage about can we destroy embryos, what is the legal right for embryos, and nobody's saying, well, what are the options, she says. It's weird that the conversations stop at when does life begin, but not what do we do in these situations on either side. But those conversations are happening, at least in some meeting rooms and living rooms. Button pointed me toward a little-noticed line in the Southern Baptist anti-IVF resolution. Parents who are struggling with infertility should consider adopting frozen embryos instead. And Burning, still working with Snowflakes, has acquired a new set of 10 embryos, frozen in 2006, so she can start the process again. She's getting ready for a transfer in January. I'm hoping, she told me, this round will end up with having a beautiful baby. This was adapted from a story that was first published in Politico. And with just a couple of minutes left for the show, we'll read some of the short notes on the Talking Points page. Planned Parenthood centers saw a 1,200% spike in vasectomy appointment requests the day after Donald Trump's election win. Appointments for IUDs and other birth control implants rose 760% and 350% respectively. Prosecutors in Ukraine have opened more than 60,000 cases against soldiers for abandoning their positions so far in 2024, nearly double the number of such cases opened in the previous 2 years of the war. With Russian forces gaining ground on all fronts, some Ukrainian deserters have complained of being outnumbered, outgunned, and undertrained. Sales of Bibles in the U.S. climbed 22% in the first 10 months of the year, compared with the same period in 2023. Overall, print book sales rose by less than 1% in that period. People are experiencing anxiety, Jeff Crosby, president of the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association, said of the Bible boom. It's related to artificial intelligence, election cycles, and all of that feeds a desire for assurance that we're going to be okay. Food insecurity is rising across the U.S., with about 65% of food banks recording an increase in the number of people served over the past year. More than 50 million people received charitable food assistance last year, up 1 million from 2022 and 10 million from 2019. And we'll wrap up today's show with a quote from Rebecca Solnit from The Guardian, who says, "Democracy is based in trust in strangers and a sense of having something in common with them, which is part of why xenophobia and fear of crime serve fascist agendas so well." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you can join us again next week. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.